Side 9. Unfinished Tales of Numenor and Middle-earth by J.R.R. Tolkien. Continuing with History of Galadriel and Celeborn on page 239. At that time also, Gil-galad gave Vilya the Blue Ring to Elrond and appointed him to be his vice-regent in Eriador. But the Red Ring he kept until he gave it to Círdan when he set out from Lindon in the days of the Last Alliance. Note 11. Earlier in this narrative, page 237, it is said that Gil-galad gave Narya the Red Ring to Círdan as soon as he himself received it from Celebrimbor, and this agrees with the statements in Appendix B to The Lord of the Rings and in Of the Rings of Power, that Círdan held it from the beginning. The statement here, at variance with the others, was added in the margin of the text. End of note. For many years the Westlands had peace and time in which to heal their wounds, but the Numenoreans had tasted power in Middle-earth, and from that time forward they began to make permanent settlements on the western coasts, dated circa 1800 in the Tale of Years, becoming too powerful for Sauron to attempt to move west out of Mordor for a long time. Editor. In its concluding passage, the narrative returns to Galadriel, telling that the sea-longing grew so strong in her that, though she deemed it her duty to remain in Middle-earth while Sauron was still unconquered, she determined to leave Lorinand and to dwell near the sea. She committed Lorinand to Amroth, and passing again through Moria with Celebrion, she came to Imladris, seeking Celeborn. There, it seems, she found him, and there they dwelt together for a long time. And it was then that Elrond first saw Celebrion and loved her, though he said nothing of it. It was while Galadriel was in Imladris that the council referred to above was held. But at some later time, there is no indication of the date, Galadriel and Celeborn, together with Celebrion, departed from Imladris and went to the little inhabited lands between the mouth of the Gwathlaw and Ethyr Anduin. There they dwelt in Belphalas, at the place that was afterwards called Dol Amroth. There Amroth, their son at times, visited them, and their company was swelled by Nondoran elves from Lorinand. It was not until far on in the Third Age, when Amroth was lost and Lorinand was in peril, that Galadriel returned there, in the year 1981. Here, the text concerning Galadriel and Celeborn comes to an end. It may be noted here that the absence of any indication to the contrary in The Lord of the Rings had led commentators to the natural assumption that Galadriel and Celeborn passed the latter half of the Second Age and all the Third in Lothlorien. But this was not so, though their story as outlined in Concerning Galadriel and Celeborn was greatly modified afterwards, as will be shown below. Amroth and Nimrodel. I have said earlier, page 234, that if Amroth were indeed thought of as the son of Galadriel and Celeborn when The Lord of the Rings was written, so important a connection could hardly have escaped mention. But whether he was or not, this view of his parentage was later rejected. I give next a short tale, dating from 1969 or later, entitled Part of the Legend of Amroth and Nimrodel, recounted in brief. Author. Amroth was king of Lorien after his father, Amdir, was slain in the Battle of Dagorlad in the year 3434 of the Second Age. His land had peace for many years after the defeat of Sauron. Though Sindarin in descent, he lived after the manner of the Sylvan elves and housed in the tall trees of a great green mound, ever after called Cairn Amroth. This he did because of his love for Nimrodel. For long years he had loved her, and taken no wife, since she would not wed with him. She loved him indeed, for he was beautiful, even for one of the Eldar, and valiant, and wise. But she was of the Sylvan elves, and regretted the incoming of the elves from the west, who, as she said, brought wars and destroyed the peace of old. She would speak only the Sylvan tongue, even after it had fallen into disuse among the folk of Lorien, and she dwelt alone beside the falls of the river Nimrodel, to which she gave her name. Note 12. On the Sylvan Elves and Their Speech, see Appendix A, page 256. End of note. But when the terror came out of Moria, and the dwarves were driven out, and in their stead orcs crept in, she fled, distraught, alone south into empty lands, in the year 1981 of the Third Age. Amroth followed her, and at last he found her, under the eaves of Fangorn, which in those days drew much nearer to Lorien. Note 13. See Appendix C, page 260. On the boundaries of Lorien. End of note. She dared not enter the wood, for the trees, she said, menaced her, and some moved to bar her way. There Amroth and Nimrodil held a long debate, and at the last they plighted their troth. "To this I will be true," she said, "and we shall be wedded when you bring me to a land of peace." Amroth vowed that for her sake he would leave his people, even in their time of need, and with her seek for such a land. "But there is none now in Middle-earth," he said, "and will not be for the elven folk ever again. We must seek for a passage over the great sea to the ancient west." Then he told her of the haven in the south, where many of his own people had come long ago. "They are now diminished, for most have set sail into the west, but the remnant of them still build ships and offer passage to any of their kin that come to them weary of Middle-earth. It is said that the grace that the Valar gave to us to pass over the sea is granted also now to any of those who made the great journey, even if they did not come in ages past to the shores and have not yet beheld the blessed land. There is not here the place to tell of their journey into the land of Gondor. It was in the days of King Earnil the Second, the last but one of the kings of the southern realm, and his lands were troubled. Earnil the Second reigned in Gondor from 1945 to 2043. Elsewhere it is told, but not in any extant writing, how they became separated, and how Amroth, after seeking her in vain, went to the Elfhaven and found that only a few still lingered there, less than a shipload, and they had only one seaworthy ship. In this they were now preparing to depart and to leave Middle-earth. They welcomed Amroth, being glad to strengthen their small company, but they were unwilling to await Nimrodil, whose coming seemed to them now beyond hope. "If she came through the settled lands of Gondor," they said, "she would not be molested and might receive help. For the men of Gondor are good, and they are ruled by descendants of the elf friends of old, who can still speak our tongue after a fashion. But in the mountains are many unfriendly men and evil things." The year was waning to autumn, and before long great winds were to be expected, hostile and dangerous, even to elven ships while they were still near to Middle-earth. But so great was the grief of Amroth that nonetheless they stayed their going for many weeks, and they lived on the ship, for their houses on the shore were stripped and empty. Then in the autumn there came a great night of storm, one of the fiercest in the annals of Gondor. It came from the cold northern waste and roared down through Eriador into the lands of Gondor, doing great havoc. The white mountains were no shield against it, and many of the ships of men were swept out into the bay of Belfalis and lost. The light elven ship was torn from its moorings and driven into the wild waters towards the coasts of Umbar. No tidings of it were ever heard in Middle-earth, but the elven ships made for this journey did not founder, and doubtless it left the circles of the world and came at last to Eressëa. But it did not bring Amroth thither. The storm fell upon the coasts of Gondor just as dawn was peering through the flying clouds. But when Amroth woke, the ship was already far from land. Crying aloud in despair, "Nimrodil!" he leapt into the sea and swam towards the fading shore. The mariners, with their elvish sight for a long time, could see him battling with the waves, until the rising sun gleamed through the clouds, and far off lit his bright hair like a spark of gold. No eyes of elves or men ever saw him again in Middle-earth. Of what befell Nimrodil, nothing is said here, though there were many legends concerning her fate. Editor. The foregoing narrative was actually composed as an offshoot from an etymological discussion of the names of certain rivers in Middle-earth. In this case, the Gilrhine. a river of Lebanon in Gondor that flowed into the Bay of Belphalis, west of Ether Anduin. And another facet of the legend of Nimrodel emerges from the discussion of the element rain. This was probably derived from the stem ran, wander, stray, go on uncertain course, as in Mithrandir, and in the name Rana of the moon. Author. This would not seem suitable to any of the rivers of Gondor, but the names of rivers may often apply only to part of their course, to their source, or to their lower reaches, or to other features that struck explorers who named them. In this case, however, the fragments of the legend of Amroth and Nimrodel offer an explanation. The Gilrine came swiftly down from the mountains, as did the other rivers of that region. But as it reached the end of the outlier of arid Nimrais that separated it from the Kilos, see the map accompanying Volume 3 of The Lord of the Rings, it ran into a wide, shallow depression. In this it wandered for a while and formed a small mere at the southern end before it cut through a ridge and went on swiftly again to join the Cerni. When Nimrodel fled from Lorien, it is said that seeking for the sea, she became lost in the White Mountains, until at last, by what road or pass is not told, she came to a river that reminded her of her own stream in Lorien. Her heart was lightened, and she sat by a mere, seeing the stars reflected in its dim waters, and listening to the waterfalls by which the river went again on its journey down to the sea. There she fell into a deep sleep of weariness, and so long she slept that she did not come down into Belphalis until Amroth's ship had been blown out to sea, and he was lost, trying to swim back to Belphalis. This legend was well known in the Dor en Ernil, the land of the prince, and no doubt the name was given in memory of it. Note 14. The origin of the name Dor en Ernil is nowhere given. Its only other occurrence is on the large map of Rohan, Gondor, and Mordor in The Lord of the Rings. On that map it is placed on the other side of the mountains from Dol Amroth, but its occurrence in the present context suggests that Ernil was the prince of Dol Amroth, which might be supposed in any case. End of note. Editor, the essay continues with a brief explanation of how Amroth as king of Lorien related to the rule there of Celeborn and Galadriel. Author, the people of Lorien were even then, that is, at the time of the loss of Amroth, much as they were at the end of the Third Age. Sylvan elves in origin, but ruled by princes of Sindarin descent, as was the realm of Thranduil in the northern parts of Mirkwood, though whether Thranduil and Amroth were akin is not now known. Note 15. See Appendix B, page 257, on the Sindarin princes of the Sylvan Elves. End of note. They had, however, been much mingled with Noldor of Sindarin speech, who passed through Moria after the destruction of Eregion by Sauron in the year 1697 of the Second Age. At that time, Elrond went westward, sick, probably meaning simply that he did not cross the Misty Mountains, and established the refuge of Imladris. But Celeborn went at first to Lorien and fortified it against any further attempts of Sauron to cross the Anduin. When, however, Sauron withdrew to Mordor and was, as reported, wholly concerned with conquests in the east, Celeborn rejoined Galadriel in Lindon. Lorien had then long years of peace and obscurity under the rule of its own king, Amdir, until the downfall of Numenor and the sudden return of Sauron to Middle-earth. Amdir obeyed the summons of Gil-galad and brought as large a force as he could muster to the Last Alliance, but he was slain in the Battle of Dagorlad, and most of his company with him. Amroth, his son, became king. Editor, this account is, of course, greatly at variance with that contained in concerning Galadriel and Celeborn. Amroth is no longer the son of Galadriel and Celeborn, but of Amdir, a prince of Sindarin origin. The older story of the relations of Galadriel and Celeborn with Eregion and Lorien seems to have been modified in many important respects, but how much of it would have been retained in any fully written narrative cannot be said. Celeborn's association with Lorien is now placed much further back. for in concerning Galadriel and Celeborn, he never went to Lorien at all during the Second Age. And we learn here that many Noldoran elves passed through Moria to Lorien after the destruction of Eregion. In the earlier account, there is no suggestion of this, and the movement of Beleriandic elves into Lorien took place under peaceful conditions many years before. Page 236. The implication of the extract just given is that after Eregion's fall, Celeborn led this migration to Lorien, while Galadriel joined Gil-galad in Lindon. But elsewhere, in a writing contemporary with this, it is said explicitly that they both at that time passed through Moria with a considerable following of Noldoran exiles and dwelt for many years in Lorien. It is neither asserted nor denied in these late writings that Galadriel, or Celeborn, had relations with Lorien before 1697, and there are no other references outside concerning Galadriel and Celeborn to Celebrimbor's revolt at some time between 1350 and 1400 against their rule in Eregion, nor to Galadriel's departure at that time to Lorien and her taking up rule there while Celeborn remained behind in Eregion. It is not made clear in the late accounts where Galadriel and Celeborn passed the long years of the Second Age after the defeat of Sauron in Eriador. There are at any rate no further mentions of their age-long sojourn in Belfalis. Page 240. The discussion of Amroth continues. Author. But during the Third Age, Galadriel became filled with foreboding, and with Celeborn she journeyed to Lorien, and stayed there long with Amroth, being especially concerned to learn all news and rumors of the growing shadow in Mirkwood and the dark stronghold in Dol Guldur. But his people were content with Amroth. He was valiant and wise, and his little kingdom was yet prosperous and beautiful. Therefore, after long journeys of inquiry in Rovanion, from Gondor and the borders of Mordor to Thranduil in the north, Celeborn and Galadriel passed over the mountains to Imladris, and there dwelt for many years, for Elrond was their kinsman, since he had early in the Third Age, in the year 109, according to the Tale of Years, wedded their daughter Celebrion. After the disaster in Moria, in the year 1980, and the sorrows of Lorien, which was now left without a ruler, for Amroth was drowned in the sea in the Bay of Belfalis and left no heir, Celeborn and Galadriel returned to Lorien and were welcomed by the people. There they dwelt while the Third Age lasted, but they took no title of king or queen, for they said that they were only guardians of this small but fair realm, the last eastward outpost of the elves. Editor. Elsewhere, there is one other reference to their movements during those years. Author. To Lorien, Celeborn and Galadriel returned twice before the last alliance and the end of the Second Age. And in the Third Age, when the shadow of Sauron's recovery arose, they dwelt there again for a long time. In her wisdom, Galadriel saw that Lorien would be a stronghold and point of power to prevent the shadow from crossing the Anduin in the war that must inevitably come before it was again defeated, if that were possible, but that it needed a rule of greater strength and wisdom than the Sylvan folk possessed. Nevertheless, it was not until the disaster in Moria, when by means beyond the foresight of Galadriel, Sauron's power actually crossed the Anduin, and Lorien was in great peril, its king lost, its people fleeing and likely to leave it deserted to be occupied by orcs, that Galadriel and Celeborn took up their permanent abode in Lorien and its government. But they took no title of king or queen, and were the guardians that in the event brought it unviolated through the War of the Ring. Editor. In another etymological discussion of the same period, the name Amroth is explained as being a nickname derived from his living in a high talan, or flet. The wooden platforms built high up in the trees of Lothlorien in which the Galadhrim dwelt. See The Fellowship of the Ring, 2:6. It meant up-climber, high-climber. Note 16. The explanation supposes that the first element in the name Amroth is the same Elvish word as Quenya, Amba, up, found also in Sindarin, Aman, a hill or mountain with steep sides. while the second element is a derivative from a stem, roth, meaning climb, whence also the noun roth, which in the Numenorean Sindarin used in Gondor in the naming of places and persons, was applied to all the longer roadways and streets of Minas Tirith, nearly all of which were on an incline. So Roth Dinan, the silent street, leading down from the citadel to the tombs of the kings. End of note. It is said here that the custom of dwelling in trees was not a habit of the Sylvan elves in general, but was developed in Lorien by the nature and situation of the land, a flat land with no good stone, except what might be quarried in the mountains westward and brought with difficulty down the Silverlode. Its chief wealth was in its trees, a remnant of the great forests of the elder days. But the dwelling in trees was not universal even in Lorien, and the telline, or flats, were in origin either refuges to be used in the event of attack, or most often, especially those high up in great trees, outlook posts from which the land and its borders could be surveyed by elvish eyes. For Lorien, after the end of the first millennium of the Third Age, became a land of uneasy vigilance, and Amroth must have dwelt in growing disquiet ever since Dol Guldur was established in Mirkwood. Author: such an outlook post, used by the wardens of the North Marches, was the flet in which Frodo spent the night. The abode of Celeborn in Caras Galadhon was also of the same origin. Its highest flet, which the Fellowship of the Ring did not see, was the highest point in the land. Earlier, the flet of Amroth at the top of the great mound or hill of Cairn Amroth, piled by the labor of many hands, had been the highest, and was principally designed to watch Dol Guldur across the Anduin. The conversion of these telline into permanent dwellings was a later development, and only in Caras Galadhon were such dwellings numerous. But Caras Galadhon was itself a fortress, and only a small part of the Galadhrim dwelt within its walls. Living in such lofty houses was no doubt at first thought remarkable, and Amroth was probably the first to do so. It was thus from his living in a high talon that his name, the only one that was later remembered in legend, was most probably derived. Editor: a note to the words Amroth was probably the first to do so states. Author: unless it was Nimrodel. Her motives were different. She loved the waters and the falls of Nimrodel, from which she would not long be parted. But as times darkened, the stream was too near the north borders, and in a part where few of the Galadhrim now dwelt. Maybe it was from her that Amroth took the idea of living in a high flet. Note 17. In the brief recounting of the legend of Amroth and Nimrodel, it is said that Amroth dwelt in the trees of Cairn Amroth because of his love for Nimrodel. Page 240. End of note. Editor: returning to the legend of Amroth and Nimrodel given above, what was the haven in the south where Amroth awaited for Nimrodel, and where, as he told her, many of his own people had come long ago? Page 241. Two passages in The Lord of the Rings bear on this question. One is in The Fellowship of the Ring 2:6, where Legolas, after singing the song of Amroth and Nimrodel, speaks of the Bay of Belfalas, whence the elves of Lorien set sail. The other is in The Return of the King 5:9, where Legolas, looking on Prince Imrahil of Dol Amroth, saw that he was one who had elven blood in his veins, and said to him, "It is long since the people of Nimrodel left the woodlands of Lorien, and yet still one may see that not all sailed from Amroth's haven west over water." To which Prince Imrahil replied, "So it is said in the lore of my land." Late and fragmentary notes go some way to explaining these references. Thus, in a discussion of linguistic and political interrelations in Middle Earth, dating from 1969 or later, there is a passing reference to the fact that in the days of the earlier settlements of Numenor, the shores of the Bay of Belfalas were still mainly desolate, except for a haven and small settlement of elves at the south of the confluence of Morthond and Ringlow, that is, just north of Dol Amroth. Author: this, according to the traditions of Dol Amroth, had been established by seafaring Sindar from the West Havens of Beleriand, who fled in three small ships when the power of Morgoth overwhelmed the Eldar and the Atani. But it was later increased by the adventurers of the Sylvan Elves seeking for the sea, who came down Anduin. Editor, the Sylvan Elves, it is remarked here, were never wholly free of an unquiet and a yearning for the sea, which at times drove some of them to wander from their homes. To relate this story of the three small ships to the traditions recorded in the Silmarillion, we would probably have to assume that they escaped from Brithombar or Eglarest, the havens of the Falas on the west coast of Beleriand, when they were destroyed in the year after the Nirnaeth Arnoidiad. The Silmarillion, page 196. But that whereas Círdan and Gil-galad made a refuge on the Isle of Balar, these three ships' companies sailed far further south down the coasts to Belfalas. But a quite different account, making the establishment of the Elvish Haven later, is given in an unfinished scrap on the origin of the name Belfalas. It is said here that while the element Bel is certainly derived from a pre-Numenorean name, its source was in fact Sindarin. The note peters out before any further information is given about Bel. But the reason given for its Sindarin origin is that there was one small but important element in Gondor of quite exceptional kind, an Eldarin settlement. After the breaking of Thangorodrim, the elves of Beleriand, if they did not take ship over the Great Sea or remain in Lindon, wandered east over the Blue Mountains into Eriador. But there appears nonetheless to have been a group of Sindar who in the beginning of the Second Age went south. They were a remnant of the people of Dorioth, who harbored still their grudge against the Noldor. And having remained a while at the Grey Havens, where they learned the craft of shipbuilding, they went in the course of years seeking a place for lives of their own, and at last they settled at the mouth of the Morthond. There was already a primitive harbor there of fisherfolk, but these, in fear of the Eldar, fled into the mountains. Note 18. The place of the Elvish Haven in Belfalas is marked with the name Edelond, Elfhaven. See the appendix to the Silmarillion under Edel and Lond, on the decorated map of Middle-earth by Pauline Baines, but I have found no other occurrence of this name. See Appendix D, page 261. Compare The Adventures of Tom Bombadil, 1962, page 8. In the Langstrand and Dol Amroth, there were many traditions of the ancient Elvish dwellings and of the haven at the mouth of the Morthond, from which westward ships had sailed as far back as the fall of Eregion in the Second Age. End of note. In a note written in December 1972 or later, and among the last writings of my father's on the subject of Middle-earth, there is a discussion of the Elvish strain in men, as to its being observable in the beardlessness of those who were so descended. It was a characteristic of all elves to be beardless, and it is here noted in connection with the princely house of Dol Amroth, that this line had a special elvish strain according to its own legends, with a reference to the speeches between Legolas and Imrahil in The Return of the King, 5-9, cited above. Author: as Legolas, mention of Nimrodel shows, there was an ancient elvish port near Dol Amroth, and a small settlement of Sylvan elves there from Lorien. The legend of the prince's line was that one of their earliest fathers had wedded an elf maiden. In some versions it was indeed, evidently improbably, said to have been Nimrodel herself. In other tales, and more probably, it was one of Nimrodel's companions, who was lost in the upper mountain glens. Editor: this latter version of the legend appears in more detailed form in a note appended to an unpublished genealogy of the line of Dol Amroth, from Ongelamar, the 20th prince, father of Adrahil, father of Imrahil, prince of Dol Amroth, at the time of the War of the Ring. Author: in the tradition of his house, Ongelamar was the 20th in unbroken descent from Galador, first lord of Dol Amroth, circa Third Age, 2004 to 2129. According to the same traditions, Galador was the son of Imrazor, the Numenorian, who dwelt in Belphalas, and the elven lady Mithrelas. She was one of the companions of Nimrodel, among many of the elves that fled to the coast about the year 1980 of the Third Age, when evil arose in Moria. And Nimrodel and her maidens strayed in the wooded hills and were lost. But in this tale, it is said that Imrazor harbored Mithrelas and took her to wife. But when she had borne him a son, Galador, and a daughter, Gilmith, she slipped away by night, and he saw her no more. But though Mithrelas was of the lesser sylvan race, and not of the high elves or the grey, it was ever held that the house and kin of the lords of Dol Amroth was noble by blood as they were fair in face and mind. The Elisar. Editor. In unpublished writing, there's little else to be found concerning the history of Celeborn and Galadriel, save for a very rough manuscript of 4 pages titled The Elisar. It is in the first stage of composition, but bears a few penciled emendations. There are no other versions. It reads, with some very slight editorial emendation, as follows. Author. There was in Gondolin a jewelsmith named Enerthil, the greatest of that craft among the Noldor after the death of Feanor. Enerthil loved all green things that grew, and his greatest joy was to see the sunlight through the leaves of trees. And it came into his heart to make a jewel within which the clear light of the sun should be imprisoned, but the jewel should be green as leaves. And he made this thing, and even the Noldor marveled at it. For it is said that those who looked through this stone saw things that were withered or burned healed again, or as they were in the grace of their youth, and that the hands of one who held it brought to all that they touched healing from hurt. This gem Enerthil gave to Idril, the king's daughter, and she wore it upon her breast. And so it was saved from the burning of Gondolin. And before Idril set sail, she said to Eärendil, her son, "The Elisar I leave with thee, for there are grievous hurts to Middle-earth which thou maybe shalt heal, but to none other shalt thou deliver it." And indeed, at Sirion's haven, there were many hurts to heal both of men and elves, and of beasts that fled thither from the horror of the north. And while Eärendil dwelt there, they were healed and prospered, and all things were for a while green and fair. But when Eärendil began his great voyages upon the sea, he wore the Elisar upon his breast, for amongst all his searchings the thought was always before him, that he might perhaps find Idril again. And his first memory of Middle-earth was the green stone above her breast, as she sang above his cradle while Gondolin was still in flower. So it was that the Elisar passed away when Eärendil returned no more to Middle-earth. In ages after, there was again an Elisar, and of this 2 things are said, though which is true only those wise could say who now are gone. For some say that the second was indeed only the first returned by the grace of the Valar, and that Olarin, who was known in Middle-earth as Mithrandir, brought it with him out of the west. And on a time, Olarin came to Galadriel, who dwelt now under the trees of Greenwood the Great, and they had long speech together, for the years of her exile began to lie heavy on the Lady of the Noldor, and she longed for news of her kin and for the blessed land of her birth, and yet was unwilling to forsake Middle-earth. This sentence was changed to read, but was not permitted yet to forsake Middle-earth. And when Olorin had told her many tidings, she sighed and said, "I grieve in Middle-earth, for leaves fall and flowers fade, and my heart yearns, remembering trees and grass that do not die. I would have these in my home." Then Olorin said, "Would you then have the Elisar?" And Galadriel said, "Where now is the stone of Eärendil? And Enerthil is gone who made it."
"Who knows?" said Olorin.
"Surely," said Galadriel, "they have passed over sea, as almost all fair things beside. And must Middle-earth then fade and perish forever?"
"That is its fate," said Olorin. "Yet for a little while that might be amended if the Elisar should return. For a little, until the days of men are come."
"If, and yet how could that be?" said Galadriel. "For surely the Valar are now removed, and Middle-earth is far from their thought, and all who cling to it are under a shadow."
"It is not so," said Olorin. "Their eyes are not dimmed, nor their hearts hardened. In token of which, look upon this."
And he held before her the Elisar, and she looked on it, and wondered. And Olorin said,
"This I bring to you, from Yavanna. Use it as you may, and for a while you shall make the land of your dwelling the fairest place in Middle-earth, but it is not for you to possess. You shall hand it on when the time comes. For before you grow weary, and at last forsake Middle-earth, one shall come who is to receive it, and his name shall be that of the stone. Elisar he shall be called. Note 19. This chimes with the passage in the Fellowship of the Ring, 2:8, where Galadriel, giving the green stone to Aragorn, said, "In this hour, take the name that was foretold for you, Elisar, the elf stone of the house of Elendil." End of note. The other tale runs so, that long ago, ere Sauron deluded the smiths of Eregion, Galadriel came there, and she said to Celebrimbor, the chief of the elven smiths, "I am grieved in Middle-earth, for leaves fall and flowers fade that I have loved, so that the land of my dwelling is filled with regret that no spring can redress." "How otherwise can it be for the Eldar, if they cling to Middle-earth?" said Celebrimbor. "Will you then pass over sea?"
"Nay," she said. "Angrod is gone, and Aignor is gone, and Felagund is no more. Of Finarfin's children I am the last."
Note 20. The text here and again immediately below has Finrod, which I have changed to Finarfin to avoid confusion. Before the revised edition of The Lord of the Rings was published in 1966, my father changed Finrod to Finarfin, while his son Felagund, previously called Inglor Felagund, became Finrod Felagund. Two passages in the appendices B and F were accordingly amended for the revised edition. It is noteworthy that Orodreth, king of Nargothrond, after Finrod Felagund, is not here named by Galadriel among her brothers. For a reason unknown to me, my father displaced the second king of Nargothrond and made him a member of the same family in the next generation. But this and associated genealogical changes were never incorporated in the narratives of the Silmarillion. End of note. But my heart is still proud. What wrong did the Golden House of Finarfin do that I should ask the pardon of the Valar, or be content with an isle in the sea whose native land was Aman the Blessed? Here I am mightier.
What would you then? Said Celebrimbor.
I would have trees and grass about me that do not die. Here, in the land that is mine, she answered. What has become of the skill of the Eldar? And Celebrimbor said,
Where now is the stone of Earendil? And Enerthil, who made it, is gone.
They have passed over sea, said Galadriel, with almost all fair things else. But must then Middle-earth fade and perish forever?
That is its fate, I deem, said Celebrimbor. But you know that I love you, though you turned to Celeborn of the Trees. And for that love I will do what I can, if haply by my art your grief can be lessened.
But he did not say to Galadriel that he himself was of Gondolin long ago, and a friend of Enerthil, though his friend in most things outrivaled him. Yet if Enerthil had not been, then Celebrimbor would have been more renowned. Therefore he took thought, and began a long and delicate labor, and so for Galadriel he made the greatest of his works, save the three rings only. And it is said that more subtle and clear was the green gem that he made than that of Enerthil, but yet its light had less power. For whereas that of Enerthil was lit by the sun in its youth, already many years had passed ere Celebrimbor began his work, and nowhere in Middle-earth was the light as clear as it had been. For though Morgoth had been thrust out into the void and could not enter again, his far shadow lay upon it. Radiant, nonetheless, was the Elisar of Celebrimbor, and he set it within a great brooch of silver in the likeness of an eagle rising upon outspread wings. Note 21. Compare the description of the Elfstone in the Fellowship of the Ring 2:8. Then Galadriel lifted from her lap a great stone of a clear green, set in a silver brooch that was wrought in the likeness of an eagle with outspread wings. And as she held it up, the gem flashed like the sun through the leaves of spring. End of note. Wielding the Elisar, all things grew fair about Galadriel until the coming of the Shadow to the forest. But afterwards, when Nenya, chief of the three, was sent to her by Celebrimbor, she needed it, as she thought, no more, and she gave it to Celebrion, her daughter, and so it came to Arwen and to Aragorn, who was called Elisar.
Note 22.
But in The Return of the King, 6-9, where the blue ring is seen on Elrond's finger, it is called Vilya, the mightiest of the three. End of note. Editor, at the end is written. Author, the Elisar was made in Gondolin by Celebrimbor, and so came to Idril, and so to Eärendil. But that passed away. But the second Elisar was made also by Celebrimbor in Eregion, at the request of the Lady Galadriel, whom he loved. And it was not under the one, being made before Sauron rose again. Editor, this narrative goes with concerning Galadriel and Celeborn in certain features, and was probably written at about the same time, or a little earlier. Celebrimbor is here again a jewelsmith of Gondolin, rather than one of the Feanorians. Compare page 235. And Galadriel is spoken of as being unwilling to forsake Middle-earth. Compare page 234. Though the text was later amended, and the conception of the ban introduced, and at a later point in the narrative, she speaks of the pardon of the Valar. Enerville appears in no other writing, and the concluding words of the text show that Celebrimbor was to displace him as the maker of the Elisar in Gondolin. Of Celebrimbor's love for Galadriel, there is no trace elsewhere. In concerning Galadriel and Celeborn, the suggestion is that he came to Eregion with them, page 235. But in that text, as in the Silmarillion, Galadriel met Celeborn in Doriath. And it is difficult to understand Celebrimbor's words, though you turned to Celeborn of the Trees. Obscure also is the reference to Galadriel's dwelling, under the trees of Greenwood the Great. This might be taken as a loose use, nowhere else evidenced, of the expression to include the woods of Lorien, on the other side of Anduin. But the coming of the shadow to the forest undoubtedly refers to the arising of Sauron in Dol Guldur, which in Appendix A, 3, to The Lord of the Rings, is called the Shadow in the Forest. This may imply that Galadriel's power at one time extended into the southern parts of Greenwood the Great, and support for this may be found in Concerning Galadriel and Celeborn, page 236, where the realm of Lorinand, Lorien, is said to have extended into the forests on both sides of the great river, including the region where afterwards was Dol Guldur. It is possible also that the same conception underlay the statement in Appendix B to The Lord of the Rings, in the headnote to the Tale of Years of the Second Age, as it appeared in the first edition. Many of the Sindar passed eastward and established realms in the forests far away. The chief of these were Thranduil in the north of Greenwood the Great, and Celeborn in the south of the forest. In the revised edition, this remark about Celeborn was omitted, and instead there appears a reference to his dwelling in Lindon, cited above, page 228. Lastly, it may be remarked that the healing power here ascribed to the Elisar at the Havens of Sirion is in the Silmarillion, page 247, attributed to the Silmaril. Appendices. Appendix A, The Sylvan Elves and Their Speech. Editor, according to the Silmarillion, page 94, some of the Nandor, the Teleran elves who abandoned the march of the Eldar on the eastern side of the Misty Mountains, dwelt age-long in the woods of the Vale of the Great River, while others, it is said, went down Anduin to its mouths, and yet others entered Eriador. From these last came the green elves of Osiriond. In a late etymological discussion of the names Galadriel, Celeborn, and Lorien, the Sylvan Elves of Mirkwood and Lorien are specifically declared to be descended from the Teleran Elves, who remained in the Vale of Anduin. Author, the Sylvan Elves, Tawarwaith, were in origin Teleri, and so remoter kin of the Sindar, though even longer separated from them than the Teleri of Valinor. They were descended from those of the Teleri, who on the great journey were daunted by the Misty Mountains and lingered in the Vale of Anduin, and so never reached Beleriand, or the sea. They were thus closer akin to the Nandor, otherwise called the Green Elves of Osiriond, who eventually crossed the mountains and came at last into Beleriand. Editor, the Sylvan Elves hid themselves in woodland fastnesses beyond the Misty Mountains, and became small and scattered peoples, hardly to be distinguished from Avari. Author,
but they still remembered that they were in origin Eldar, members of the Third Clan, and they welcomed those of the Noldor, and especially the Sindar, who did not pass over the sea, but migrated eastward, that is, at the beginning of the Second Age. Under the leadership of these, they became again ordered folk, and increased in wisdom. Thranduil, father of Legolas of the Nine Walkers, was Sindarin, and that tongue was used in his house, though not by all his folk. In Lorien, where many of the people were Sindar in origin, or Noldor, survivors from Eregion, see page 243, Sindarin had become the language of all the people. In what way their Sindarin differed from the forms of Beleriand, see The Fellowship of the Ring, 2-6, where Frodo reports that the speech of the Sylvan folk that they used among themselves was unlike that of the West, is not, of course, now known. It probably differed in little more than what would now be popularly called accent, mainly differences of vowel sounds and intonation sufficient to mislead one who, as Frodo, was not well acquainted with purer Sindarin. There may, of course, also have been some local words and other features, ultimately due to the influence of the former Sylvan tongue. Lorien had long been much isolated from the outside world. Certainly some names preserved from its past, such as Amroth and Nimrodel, cannot be fully explained from Sindarin, though fitting it in form. Karas seems to be an old word for a moated fortress not found in Sindarin. Lorien is probably an alteration of an older name now lost, though earlier the original Sylvan or Nondoran name was stated to be Lorinand. See page 252, note 5. Editor, with these remarks on Sylvan names, compare Appendix F, 1, to the Lord of the Rings section of the Elves, footnote, appearing only in the revised edition. Another general statement concerning Sylvan Elvish is found in a linguistic historical discussion dating from the same late period as that just cited. Author, although the dialects of the Sylvan Elves, when they again met their long-separated kindred, had so far diverged from Sindarin as to be hardly intelligible, little study was needed to reveal their kinship as Eldarin tongues. Though the comparison of the Sylvan dialects with their own speech greatly interested the lore masters, especially those of Noldoran origin, little is now known of the Sylvan Elvish. The Sylvan Elves had invented no forms of writing, and those who learned this art from the Sindar wrote in Sindarin as well as they could. By the end of the Third Age, the Sylvan tongues had probably ceased to be spoken in the two regions that had importance at the time of the War of the Ring, Lorien and the realm of Thranduil in northern Mirkwood. All that survived of them in the records was a few words and several names of persons and places. Appendix B. The Sindarin Princes of the Sylvan Elves. Editor, in Appendix B to The Lord of the Rings, in the headnote to the Tale of Years of the Second Age, it is said that before the building of the Barad-dûr, many of the Sindar passed eastward, and some established realms in the forests far away, where their people were mostly Sylvan Elves. Thranduil, king in the north of Greenwood the Great, was one of these. Something more of the history of these Sindarin princes of the Sylvan Elves is found in my father's late philological writings. Thus, in one essay, Thranduil's realm is said to have, author, extended into the woods, surrounding the lonely mountain, and growing along the west shores of the Long Lake, before the coming of the dwarves exiled from Moria and the invasion of the dragon. The elvish folk of this realm had migrated from the south, being the kin and neighbors of the elves of Lorien. But they had dwelt in Greenwood the Great east of Anduin. In the Second Age, their king, Orofer, the father of Thranduil, father of Legolas, had withdrawn northward beyond the Gladden Fields. This he did to be free from the power and encroachments of the dwarves of Moria, which had grown to be the greatest of the mansions of the dwarves recorded in history. And also, he resented the intrusions of Celeborn and Galadriel into Lorien. But as yet there was little to fear between the greenwood and the mountains, and there was constant intercourse between his people and their kin across the river, until the War of the Last Alliance. Despite the desire of the Sylvan Elves to meddle as little as might be in the affairs of the Noldor and Sindar, or of any other peoples, dwarves, men, or orcs, Orofer had the wisdom to foresee that peace would not return unless Sauron was overcome. He therefore assembled a great army of his now numerous people,
and joining with the lesser army of Mal'Galad of Lorien, he led the host of the Sylvan Elves to battle. The Sylvan Elves were hardy and valiant, but ill-equipped with armor or weapons in comparison with the Eldar of the West. Also, they were independent and not disposed to place themselves under the supreme command of Gil-galad. Their losses were thus more grievous than they need have been, even in that terrible war. Mal'Galad and more than half his following perished in the great battle of the Dagorlad, being cut off from the main host and driven into the dead marshes. Orofer was slain in the first assault upon Mordor, rushing forward at the head of his most doughty warriors before Gil-galad had given the signal for the advance. Thranduil, his son, survived, but when the war ended and Sauron was slain, as it seemed, he led back home barely a third of the army that had marched to war. Editor, Mal'Galad of Lorien occurs nowhere else and is not said here to be the father of Amroth. On the other hand, Amdir, father of Amroth, is twice, pages 240 and 243 above, said to have been slain in the Battle of Dagorlad, and it seems therefore that Mal'Galad can be simply equated with Amdir, but which name replaced the other, I cannot say. This essay continues. Author, a long peace followed, in which the numbers of the Sylvan Elves grew again, but they were unquiet and anxious, feeling the change of the world that the Third Age would bring. Men also were increasing in numbers and in power. The dominion of the Numenorean kings of Gondor was reaching out northwards towards the borders of Lorien and the Greenwood. The free men of the north, so called by the elves because they were not under the rule of the Dunedain and had not for the most part been subjected by Sauron or his servants, were spreading southwards, mostly east of the Greenwood, though some were establishing themselves in the eaves of the forest and the grasslands of the vales of Anduin. More ominous were rumors from the further east. The wild men were restless. Former servants and worshippers of Sauron, they were released now from his tyranny, but not from the evil and darkness that he had set in their hearts. Cruel wars raged among them, from which some were withdrawing westward, with minds filled with hatred, regarding all that dwelt in the west as enemies to be slain and plundered. But there was in Thranduil's heart a still deeper shadow. He had seen the horror of Mordor, and could not forget it. If ever he looked south, its memory dimmed the light of the sun, and though he knew that it was now broken and deserted, and under the vigilance of the kings of men, fear spoke in his heart that it was not conquered forever. It would arise again. Editor, in another passage written at the same time as the foregoing, it is said that when 1,000 years of the Third Age had passed, and the shadow fell upon Greenwood the Great, the Sylvan Elves, ruled by Thranduil, author, retreated before it as it spread ever northward, until at last Thranduil established his realm in the northeast of the forest, and delved there a fortress and great halls underground. Orofer was of Sindarin origin, and no doubt Thranduil his son was following the example of King Thingol long before, in Dorioth, though his halls were not to be compared with Menegroth. He had not the arts, nor the wealth, nor the aid of the dwarves, and compared with the elves of Dorioth, his sylvan folk were rude and rustic. Orofer had come among them with only a handful of Sindar, and they were soon merged with the Sylvan Elves, adopting their language and taking names of Sylvan form and style. This they did deliberately, for they, and other similar adventurers forgotten in the legends or only briefly named, came from Dorioth after its ruin, and had no desire to leave Middle-earth, nor to be merged with the other Sindar of Beleriand, dominated by the Noldoran exiles, for whom the folk of Dorioth had no great love. They wished indeed to become Sylvan folk, and to return, as they said, to the simple life natural to the elves before the invitation of the Valar had disturbed it. Editor, nowhere, I believe, is it made clear how the adoption of the Sylvan speech by the Sindarin rulers of the Sylvan Elves of Mirkwood, as described here, is to be related to the statement cited on page 257, that by the end of the Third Age, Sylvan Elvish had ceased to be spoken in Thranduil's realm. See further note 14 to the Disaster of the Gladden Fields, page 280. Appendix C, The Boundaries of Lorien. In Appendix A, 1-4, to the Lord of the Rings, the kingdom of Gondor at the summit of its power in the days of King Hiarmendakil I, Third Age, 1015 to 1149, is said to have extended northwards to Celebrant and the southern eaves of Mirkwood. This my father stated several times to be in error. The correct reading should be to the field of Celebrant. According to his late writing on the interrelations of the languages of Middle-earth, author, the river Celebrant, Silverlode, was within the borders of the realm of Lorien and the effective bounds of the kingdom of Gondor in the north, west of Anduin, was the river Limlight. The whole of the grasslands between Silverlode and Limlight, into which the woods of Lorien formerly extended further south, were known in Lorien as Parth Celebrant, that is, the field or enclosed grassland of Silverlode, and regarded as part of its realm, though not inhabited by its elvish folk beyond the eaves of the woods. In later days, Gondor built a bridge over the upper Limlight, and often occupied the narrow land between the lower Limlight and Anduin as part of its eastern defenses, since the great loops of the Anduin, where it came down swiftly past Lorien and entered low flat lands before its descent again into the chasm of the Emyn Muil, had many shallows and wide shoals, over which a determined and well-equipped enemy could force a crossing by rafts or pontoons, especially in the two westward bends, known as the North and South Undeeps. It was to this land that the name Parth Celebrant was applied in Gondor, hence its use in defining the ancient northern boundary. In the time of the War of the Ring, when all the land north of the White Mountains, save Anorion, as far as the Limlight, had become part of the Kingdom of Rohan, the name Parth, Field of Celebrant, was only used of the great battle in which Eorl the Young destroyed the invaders of Gondor. See page 299. Editor, in another essay, my father noted that whereas east and west the land of Lorien was bounded by Anduin and by the mountains, and he says nothing about any extension of the realm of Lorien across the Anduin, see page 252, it had no clearly defined borders northward and southward. Author, of old, the Galadhrim had claimed to govern the woods as far as the falls in the Silverlode, where Frodo was bathed. Southward, it had extended far beyond the Silverlode into more open woodland of smaller trees that merged into Fangorn Forest, though the heart of the realm had always been in the angle between Silverlode and Anduin, where Caras Galadhon stood. There were no visible borders between Lorien and Fangorn, but neither the Ents nor the Galadhrim ever passed them, for legend reported that Fangorn himself had met the king of the Galadhrim in ancient days, and Fangorn had said, I know mine, and you know yours. Let neither side molest what is the other's. But if an elf should wish to walk in my land for his pleasure, he will be welcome. And if an Ent should be seen in your land, fear no evil. Long years had passed, however, since Ent or elf had set foot in the other land. Appendix D. The Port of Lond Dyre. Editor, it was told in Concerning Galadriel and Celeborn that in the war against Sauron in Eriador at the end of the 17th century of the Second Age, the Numenorean admiral Kiriatur put a strong force ashore at the mouth of the Gwothlaw, Greyflood, where there was a small Numenorean harbor. Page 239. This seems to be the first reference to that port, of which a good deal is told in later writings. The fullest account is in the philological essay concerning the names of rivers, which has already been cited in connection with the legend of Amroth and Nimrodel, pages 242 and the following. In this essay, the name Gwothlaw is discussed as follows. Author, the river Gwothlaw is translated Greyflood, but Gwoth is a Sindarin word for shadow, in the sense of dim light, owing to cloud or mist, or in deep valleys. This does not seem to fit the geography. The wide lands divided by the Gwothlaw into the regions called by the Numenoreans Minhirioth, between the rivers Barandwin and Gwothlaw, and Enedwaith, Middlefolk, were mainly plains, open and mountainless. At the point of the confluence of Glanduin and Mith-Aethel, Horwell,
The land was almost flat, and the waters became sluggish and tended to spread into fenland. Footnote: the Glanduin, border river, flowed down from the Misty Mountains, south of Moria, to join the Mithaethel, above Tharbad. On the original map to the Lord of the Rings, the name was not marked. It only occurs once in the book, in Appendix A, 1-3. It seems that in 1969 my father communicated to Miss Pauline Baines certain additional names for inclusion in her decorated map of Middle-earth. Etherlond, referred to above, page 255, note 18. Andrast, Druwaithjaur, Old Pukel Land. Lond Dyer, Ruins. Aaron Vorn, R. Adorn, Swanfleet, and R. Glanduin. The last three of these names were then written into the original map that accompanies the book, but why this was done I have been unable to discover, and while R. Adorn is correctly placed, Swanfleet and River Glondin, Sick, are blunderingly placed against the upper course of the Isen. For the correct interpretation of the relation between the names Glanduin and Swanfleet, see pages 264 and 265. End of footnote. But some 100 miles below Tharbad, the slope increased. The Gwathlaw, however, never became swift, and ships of smaller draft could without difficulty sail or be rowed as far as Tharbad. The origin of the name Gwathlaw must be sought in history. In the time of the War of the Ring, the lands were still in places well wooded, especially in Minhirioth, and in the southeast of Enedwaith. But most of the plains were grasslands. Since the Great Plague of the year 1636 of the Third Age, Minhirioth had been almost entirely deserted, though a few secretive hunter folk lived in the woods. In Enedwaith, the remnants of the Dunlendings lived in the east, in the foothills of the Misty Mountains, and a fairly numerous but barbarous fisher folk dwelt between the mouths of the Gwathlaw and the Angren, Isen. But in the earlier days, at the time of the first explorations of the Numenoreans, the situation was quite different. Minhirioth and Enedwaith were occupied by vast and almost continuous forests, except in the central region of the Great Fens. The changes that followed were largely due to the operations of Tar Aldarion, the Mariner King, who formed a friendship and alliance with Gil-galad. Aldarion had a great hunger for timber, desiring to make Numenor into a great naval power. His felling of trees in Numenor had caused great dissensions. In voyages down the coasts, he saw with wonder the great forests, and he chose the estuary of the Gwathlaw for the site of a new haven, entirely under Numenorean control. Gondor, of course, did not yet exist. There he began great works that continued to be extended after his days. This entry into Eriador later proved of great importance in the war against Sauron, Second Age, 1693 to 1701. But it was in origin a timber port and shipbuilding harbor. The native people were fairly numerous and warlike, but they were forest dwellers, scattered communities without central leadership. They were in awe of the Numenoreans, but they did not become hostile until the tree felling became devastating. Then they attacked and ambushed the Numenoreans when they could, and the Numenoreans treated them as enemies and became ruthless in their fellings, giving no thought to husbandry or replanting. The fellings had at first been along both banks of the Gwathlaw, and timber had been floated down to the haven, Lond Dyer. But now the Numenoreans drove great tracks and roads into the forests northwards and southwards from the Gwathlaw, and the native folk that survived fled from Minhirioth into the dark woods of the great cape of Aaron Vorn, south of the mouth of the Barandwin, which they dared not cross, even if they could, for fear of the elven folk. From Enedwaith they took refuge in the eastern mountains, where afterwards was Dunland. They did not cross the Isen, nor take refuge in the great promontory between Isen and Lefnui, that formed the north arm of the Bay of Belfalis. Ros Morthil, or Andrast, see page 214, note 6, because of the Pukel men. For the continuation of this passage, see page 383. The devastation wrought by the Numenoreans was incalculable. For long years these lands were their chief source of timber, not only for their shipyards at Lond Dyer and elsewhere, but also for Numenor itself. Shiploads innumerable passed west, over the sea. The denuding of the lands was increased during the war in Eriador, for the exiled natives welcomed Sauron and hoped for his victory over the men of the sea. Sauron knew of the importance to his enemies of the Great Haven and its shipyards, and he used these haters of Numenor as spies and guides for his raiders. He had not enough force to spare for any assault upon the forts at the Haven or along the banks of the Guathlaw, but his raiders made much havoc on the fringe of the forests, setting fire in the woods and burning many of the great wood stores of the Numenoreans. When Sauron was at last defeated and driven east out of Eriador, most of the old forests had been destroyed. The Guathlaw flowed through a land that was far and wide on either bank a desert, treeless but untilled. That was not so when it first received its name from the hardy explorers of Tar Aldarion's ship, who ventured to pass up the river in small boats. As soon as the seaward region of salt airs and great winds was passed, the forest drew down to the river banks, and wide though the waters were, the huge trees cast great shadows on the river, under which the boats of the adventurers crept silently up into the unknown land. So the first name they gave to it was River of Shadow, Gwalthir, Gwalthir. But later they penetrated northward as far as the beginning of the great fenlands. Though it was still long before they had the need or sufficient men to undertake the great works of drainage and dike-building that made a great port on the site where Tharbad stood in the days of the two kingdoms. The Sindarin word that they used for the Fenland was law, earlier loga, from a stem log, meaning wet, soaked, swampy, and they thought at first that it was the source of the forest river, not yet knowing the Mithaethel that came down out of the mountains in the north, and gathering the waters of the Bruinen, Loud Water, and Glondowin, poured floodwaters into the plain. The name Gwalthir was thus changed to Gwalthlaw, the shadowy river from the fens. The Gwalthlaw was one of the few geographical names that became generally known to others than mariners in Numenor, and received an Adunaic translation. This was Agatharush. Editor, the history of Lond Dyer and Tharbad is also mentioned in this same essay in a discussion of the name Glondowin. Author, Glondowin means border river. It was the name first given in the Second Age, since the river was the southern boundary of Eregion, beyond which pre-Numenorean and generally unfriendly peoples lived, such as the ancestors of the Dunlendings. Later, it, with the Gwalthlaw, formed by its confluence with the Mithaethel, formed the southern boundary of the North Kingdom. The land beyond, between the Gwalthlaw and the Isen, Sir Angren, was called Enedwaith, Middle Folk. It belonged to neither kingdom, and received no permanent settlements of men of Numenorean origin. But the great north-south road, which was the chief route of communication between the two kingdoms, except by sea, ran through it from Tharbad to the fords of Isen, Ethryd Engrin. Before the decay of the North Kingdom and the disasters that befell Gondor, indeed until the coming of the Great Plague in Third Age 1636, both kingdoms shared an interest in this region, and together built and maintained the bridge of Tharbad, and the long causeways that carried the road to it on either side of the Gwalthlaw and Mithaethel across the fens and the plains of Minhirioth and Enedwaith. Footnote. In the early days of the kingdoms, the most expeditious route from one to the other, except for great armaments, was found to be by sea to the ancient port at the head of the estuary of the Gwalthlaw, and so to the river port of Tharbad, and thence by the road. The ancient seaport and its great quays were ruinous, but with long labor a port capable of receiving seagoing vessels had been made at Tharbad, and a fort raised there on great earthworks on both sides of the river to guard the once-famed bridge of Tharbad. The ancient port was one of the earliest ports of the Numenoreans, begun by the renowned mariner king Tar Aldarion, and later enlarged and fortified. It was called Lond Dyer Enedd, the Great Middle Haven, as being between Lindon in the north and Pelargir on the Anduin. Author's note. End of footnote. A considerable garrison of soldiers, mariners, and engineers had been kept there until the 17th century of the Third Age. But from then onwards, the region fell quickly into decay, and long before the time of the Lord of the Rings had gone back into wild fenlands. When Boromir made his great journey from Gondor to Rivendell, the courage and hardihood required is not fully recognized in the narrative, the north-south road no longer existed, except for the crumbling remains of the causeways, by which a hazardous approach to Tharbad might be achieved, only to find ruins on dwindling mounds, and a dangerous ford formed by the ruins of the bridge, impassable if the river had not been there slow and shallow, but wide. If the name Glondwin was remembered at all, it would only be in Rivendell, and it would apply only to the upper course of the river where it still ran swiftly, soon to be lost in the plains and disappear in the fens. A network of swamps, pools, and eyots, where the only inhabitants were hosts of swans and many other water birds. If the river had any name, it was in the language of the Dunlendings. In The Return of the King, 6-6, it is called the Swanfleet River, not river, simply as being the river that went down into Nin in Eilf, the waterlands of the swans. Footnote. Sindarin Alf, a swan, plural, Eilf. Quenya, Alqua, as in Alqualonde. The Teleran branch of Eldarin shifted original qu to p, but original p remained unshifted. The much-changed Sindarin of Middle-earth turned the stops to spirants after L and R. Thus, original Alqua became Alpa in Teleran, and Alf, transcribed Alf in Sindarin. End of footnote. Editor, it was my father's intention to enter, in a revised map of the Lord of the Rings, Glondwin as the name of the upper course of the river, and to mark the fens as such with the name Nin in Eilf, or Swanfleet. In the event his intention came to be misunderstood, for on Pauline Bain's map, the lower course is marked as R. Swanfleet, while on the map in the book, as noted above, page 262, the names are placed against the wrong river. It may be noted that Tharbad is referred to as a ruined town in the Fellowship of the Ring, 2-3, and that Boromir in Lothlorien told that he lost his horse at Tharbad at the fording of the Grey Flood, Ibid, 2-8. In the Tale of Years, the ruining and desertion of Tharbad is dated to the year 2012 of the Third Age, when great floods devastated Enedwaith and Minherioth. From these discussions, it can be seen that the conception of the Numenorean harbor at the mouth of the Guathlaw had been expanded since the time when Concerning Galadriel and Celeborn was written, from a small Numenorean harbor to Lond Dyer, the Great Haven. It is, of course, the Vinyalonde, or New Haven of Aldarion and Arrendis, page 176, though that name does not appear in the discussions just cited. It is said in Aldarion and Arrendis, page 206, that the works that Aldarion began again at Vinyalonde, after he became king, were never completed. This probably means no more than that they were never completed by him. For the later history of Lond Dyer presupposes that the haven was at length restored and made secure from the assaults of the sea. And indeed, the same passage in Aldarion and Arrendis goes on to say that Aldarion laid the foundation for the achievement of Tar Minastir, long years after, in the first war with Sauron. And but for his works, the fleets of Numenor could not have brought their power in time to the right place, as he foresaw. The statement, in the discussion of Glondwin above, that the port was called Lond Dyer Enedd, the Great Middle Haven, as being between the havens of Lindon in the north and Pelargir on the Anduin, must refer to a time long after the Numenorean intervention in the war against Sauron in Eriador. For according to the Tale of Years, Pelargir was not built until the year 2350 of the Second Age, and became the chief haven of the faithful Numenoreans. Appendix E. The Names of Celeborn and Galadriel. It is said in an essay concerning the customs of name-giving among the Eldar and Valinor that they had two given names, Esse, of which the first was given at birth by the father, and this one usually recalled the father's own name, resembling it in sense or form, or might even be actually the same as the father's, to which some distinguishing prefix might be added later, when the child was full grown. The second name was given later, sometimes much later, but sometimes soon after the birth, by the mother. And these mother names had great significance, for the mothers of the Eldar had insight into the characters and abilities of their children, and many also had the gift of prophetic foresight. In addition, any of the Eldar might acquire an epese, afternamen, not necessarily given by their own kin, a nickname, mostly given as a title of admiration or honor. And an epese might become the name generally used and recognized in later song and history, as was the case, for instance, with Erenion, always known by his epese, Gil-galad. Thus the name Alatariel, which, according to the late version of the story of their relationship, page 231, was given to Galadriel by Celeborn in Aman, was an epese. For its etymology, see the appendix to the Silmarillion, entry Call, which she chose to use in Middle-earth, rendered into Sindarin as Galadriel, rather than her father name, Artanis, or her mother name, Nerwin. It is only, of course, in the late version that Celeborn appears with a high elven rather than Sindarin name, Teleporno. This is stated to be actually Teleran in form. The ancient stem of the elvish word for silver was Celeb, becoming Celeb. In Sindarin, Telep, Telpe in Teleran, and Tielep, Tielpe in Quenya. But in Quenya, the form Telpe became usual, through the influence of Teleran. For the Teleri prized silver above gold, and their skill as silversmiths was esteemed even by the Noldor. Thus, Telperion was more commonly used than Tielperion, as the name of the white tree of Valinor. Alatariel was also Teleran. Its Quenya form was Altariel. The name Celeborn, when first devised, was intended to mean silver tree. It was also the name of the tree of Tol Eressëa, the Silmarillion, page 59. Celeborn's close kin had tree names, page 233. Galadhon, his father, Galathil, his brother, and Nimloth, his niece, who bore the same name as the white tree of Numenor. In my father's latest philological writings, however, the meaning silver tree was abandoned. The second element of Celeborn, as the name of a person, was derived from the ancient adjectival form orna, uprising, tall, rather than from the related noun orne, tree. Orne was originally applied to straighter and more slender trees, such as birches, whereas stouter, more spreading trees, such as oaks and beeches, were called in the ancient language galada, great growth. But this distinction was not always observed in Quenya and disappeared in Sindarin, where all trees came to be called galav, and orn fell out of common use, surviving only in verse and songs and in many names both of persons and of trees. That Celeborn was tall is mentioned in a note to the discussion of Numenorean linear measures, page 286. On occasional confusion of Galadriel's name with the word Galav, my father wrote, author, when Celeborn and Galadriel became the rulers of the elves of Lorien, who were mainly in origin Sylvan elves and called themselves the Galadhrim, the name of Galadriel became associated with trees, an association that was aided by the name of her husband, which also appeared to contain a tree word. So that outside Lorien, among those whose memories of the ancient days and Galadriel's history had grown dim, her name was often altered to Galadriel, not in Lorien itself. Editor, it may be mentioned here that Galadhrim is the correct spelling of the name of the elves of Lorien, and similarly, Caras Galadhon. My father originally altered the voiced form of TH, as in modern English then, in Elvish names to D, since, as he wrote, DH is not used in English and looks uncouth. Afterwards, he changed his mind on the point, but Galadhrim and Caras Galadhon remained uncorrected until after the appearance of the revised edition of The Lord of the Rings. In recent reprints, the change has been made. These names are wrongly spelt in the entry Alda in the appendix to the Silmarillion.
Part 3. The Third Age. 1. The Disaster of the Gladden Fields. After the fall of Sauron, Isildur, the son and heir of Elendil, returned to Gondor. There he assumed the Elendilmere as king of Arnor and proclaimed his sovereign lordship over all the Dunedain in the north and in the south, for he was a man of great pride and vigor. Note 1. The Elendilmere is named in a footnote to Appendix A, 1-3, to The Lord of the Rings. The kings of Arnor wore no crown, but bore a single white gem, the Elendilmere, Star of Elendil, bound on their brows with a silver fillet. This note gives references to other mentions of the Star of Elendil in the course of the narrative. There were, in fact, not one, but two gems of this name. See page 277. End of note. He remained for a year in Gondor, restoring its order and defining its bounds, but the greater part of the army of Arnor returned to Eriador by the Numenorean road from the fords of Isen to Fornost. Note 2. As is related in the tale of Cirion and Eorl, drawing on older histories now mostly lost, for its account of the events that led to the oath of Eorl and the alliance of Gondor with the Rohirrim. Author's note. See page 308. End of note. When he at last felt free to return to his own realm, he was in haste, and he wished to go first to Imladris, for he had left his wife and youngest son there, and he had, moreover, an urgent need for the counsel of Elrond. Note 3. Isildur's youngest son was Valandil, third king of Arnor. See of the Rings of Power in the Silmarillion, pages 295 and 296. In Appendix A, 1-2, to The Lord of the Rings, it is stated that he was born in Imladris. End of note. He therefore determined to make his way north from Osgiliath, up the vales of Anduin, to Cirith Forn and Androth, the high climbing pass of the north that led down to Imladris. Note 4. This pass is named only here by an elvish name. At Rivendell, long after Gimli the Dwarf referred to it as the High Pass, if it were not for the Beornings, the passage from Dale to Rivendell would long ago have become impossible. They are valiant men, and keep open the High Pass and the Ford of Kerak. The Fellowship of the Ring, 2-1. It was in this pass that Thorin Oakenshield and his company were captured by orcs. The Hobbit, Chapter 4. Androth no doubt means long climb. See page 255, note 16. End of note. He knew the land well, for he had journeyed there often before the War of the Alliance, and had marched that way to the war with men of eastern Arnor in the company of Elrond. Note 5. Compare of the Rings of Power in the Silmarillion, page 295. Isildur marched north from Gondor by the way that Elendil had come. End of note. It was a long journey, but the only other way, west and then north to the road meeting in Arnor, and then east to Imladris, was far longer. Note 6. 300 leagues and more, that is by the route which Isildur intended to take, and for the most part without made roads. In those days, the only Numenorean roads were the great road linking Gondor and Arnor through Colinarthon, then north over the Guathlaw at Tharbad, and so at last to Fornost, and the east-west road from the Grey Havens to Imladris. These roads crossed at a point, Bree, west of Amansul, Weathertop, by Numenorean road measurements, 392 leagues from Osgiliath, and then east to Imladris, 116. 508 leagues in all. Author's note. See the appendix on Numenorean linear measures, page 285. End of note. As swift, maybe, for mounted men, but he had no horses fit for riding. Safer, maybe, in former days, but Sauron was vanquished, and the people of the Vales had been his allies in victory. Note 7.
The Numenoreans in their own land possessed horses, which they esteemed. See the description of Numenor, page 169. But they did not use them in war, for all their wars were overseas. Also they were of great stature and strength, and their fully equipped soldiers were accustomed to bear heavy armor and weapons. In their settlements on the shores of Middle-earth, they acquired and bred horses, but used them little for riding, except in sport and pleasure. In war they were used only by couriers and by bodies of light-armed archers, often not of Numenorean race. In the War of the Alliance, such horses as they used had suffered great losses, and few were available in Osgiliath. Author's note. End of note. He had no fear, save for weather and weariness, but these men must endure whom need sends far abroad in Middle-earth. Note 8. They needed some baggage and provisions in houseless country, for they did not expect to find any dwellings of elves or men until they reached Thranduil's realm, almost at their journey's end. On the march, each man carried with him 2 days' provisions, other than the need wallet mentioned in the text, page 276. The rest and other baggage was carried by small, sturdy horses of a kind, it was said, that had first been found wild and free in the wide plains south and east of the Greenwood. They had been tamed, but though they would carry heavy burdens at walking pace, they would not allow any man to ride them. Of these, they had only 10. Author's note. End of note. So it was, as is told in the legends of later days, that the second year of the Third Age was waning when Isildur set forth from Osgiliath early in Ivanith, expecting to reach Imladris in 40 days by mid-Narbeleth, ere winter drew nigh in the north. Note 9. Yavanie 5. According to the Numenorean king's reckoning, still kept with little change in the Shire calendar.